As technology changes the nature of work and life, it's often the predictions that are made by their inventors and marketeers that we most need to challenge, as their underlying assumptions frequently prove to be wrong. For example, take the vision of the paperless office. As technologies made pervasive, instant global communications possible in the 1990s, we would no longer need to send and store paper-based documents. And to a certain extent, that's been true for a few highly disciplined organizations. But for most of us, we like reading and handling physical documents, and the ease of these technologies, including personal printers, has resulted in the exponential growth of paper usage. In the UK, the average office worker uses 10,000 sheets of paper a year, and US workers, which only represent 5% of the global population, use 30% of the world's paper production. Another unanticipated effect has been on writing. In the 1990s, managers in Western Europe received on average 10 pieces of inbound mail a day from letters, faxes, and in-house memos. That's a staggering difference to today's overflowing inboxes with hundreds of messages, some containing huge documents, legal agreements, spreadsheets, and PowerPoint decks. The consequence of the ease of digital distribution is that we're writing more than we've ever done before. McKinsey reckons that reading and writing email alone accounts for 30% of our day. In this show, we talk to Rob Ashton, who's currently researching the effects of the written word, looking at the neuroscience studies about how it makes us feel, think, and see. In other words, how writing influences our mindset.
Hi friends, welcome back to the Evolving Leader Podcast, the show born from the belief that we need deeper and more committed leadership to confront the world's biggest challenges. I'm Scott Allender.
And I'm John Gomes.
How are you feeling today, Mr. Gomes?
I'm feeling really playful, actually. I'm feeling very happy that it's the weekend, and I'm also feeling that despite all of the economic turmoil that's around, there's also a lot of optimism and interesting ideas coming from leaders in different spaces. So I'm feeling good. How are you feeling, Scott?
I'm feeling old. I've suddenly got a tennis elbow, and I don't even play tennis. So it's been a growing problem the last few weeks. So I don't know. I'm feeling a little bit old, but I am feeling a bit playful too. I like that word. We'll go with that, and I think we're going to have a playful show today, and we're joined today by Rob Ashton. Rob is an author, entrepreneur, and former scientist who has had a lifelong fascination with how the things we read and write influence what we think and do. He's been researching the science behind the process of reading and writing for a number of years, and his research runs the gamut of cognitive and social neuroscience, cognitive and social psychology, and behavioral and neuroeconomics. This has given him a unique perspective on why so much of our written communication simply doesn't work. He's also a successful entrepreneur, having founded the global learning company Emphasis in 1998. The company has so far enabled over 70,000 people to make more impact with their professional writing. High-profile clients of his include all the big four accounting firms, big tech, big pharma, and the UK Prime Minister's office, and even the royal household at Buckingham Palace. Rob, welcome to the Evolving Leader.
Hey guys, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Rob, welcome to the show. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling great. Yeah, it's been a very busy week, John, and it's that the weekend seems to have arrived with I wasn't expecting it to be Friday already, that's for sure, but now I'm feeling really good. It's been a good week.
So given your background as a scientist, I'm really intrigued to understand how you got to the point where you turned that into this topic and this passion around how we communicate, how we write, and how that translates into how people understand things. Can you give us a little sense of that journey that you've been on to get here?
Yeah, it's a great question because it's been quite a journey. I started off, my degree was... microbiology, and I then trained as a molecular biologist and worked on one of the first tests for HIV. And so it's been, you know, quite how I've ended up here is you know, I certainly couldn't have planned it and didn't plan it. I think really I was always interested in the written word. My two strongest suits at school were at high school were biology or science and English language, and so I think the English language part never went away. I wasn't really suited to what scientists call working at the bench, and eventually the lab, the being in the lab, just that kind of. I was even reading poetry when I was waiting for my experiments to finish running. So I think the writing was on the wall there, almost literally. So I got out. I trained as an editor. Went into science publishing, journal publishing, and then in consumer publishing. And what I found I was doing, I certainly got my 10,000 hours of going through content that was often impenetrable, and using the techniques that any good editor should really know to try to bring out the message, make things flow. And of course, there was a commercial imperative. People were paying for this stuff. So this was back when people actually read magazines in hard copy and would pay for it, you know. So it had to be good. It had to be readable. Otherwise, the magazine wouldn't sell, or the journal, we'd lose subscribers. And it just occurred to me that I was doing the same things over and over again. This almost became what biologists would call a simple spinal reflex. It was like I could go through, edit something without really understanding the topic at all to begin with, and then go back and read it again and see what the author was really trying to say. And I just thought, well, this is mad. I should be sharing these techniques with the wider world. So I decided to set up a training consultancy to do exactly that, which was a stupid idea because people just didn't know they needed those skills. Or more accurately, they didn't know what good looked like. So it was only when you got them on a training course and you were able to enable them to transform what they were writing that they would go, "Oh, really, I can't believe I tried to write anything before without knowing this stuff." But before, they didn't know that they didn't know that stuff. So it was a slow start. And back then, people were talking about how writing was on the way out. And so that combination meant that, it was tricky to begin with. But it started to take off eventually. It was just me to begin with. And then it built, and I think we got a large contract after about 2 years, which really helped. And it, you know, at the time, we were kind of really living from payroll to payroll, or payrun to payrun. And that gave us some funding. We've never received outside funding, but that gave us some cash that enabled us to expand. And from there, we built a team of trainers, built a trainer development program, which is quite extensive, and the application process is quite onerous, so that we can maintain the quality. And the only thing that company does is written communication, so it has to be good. And so it continued for another 24 years. That company is still going, still very much alive and kicking. I think it's probably more like 80,000 people that it's trained now, and that's all been in groups of 8 to 10, so there's no kind of stack 'em high. So that was an enormous privilege. But I handed over the reins a couple of months ago to focus on this. I've gone back to the science, and I was always curious about the science of effective communication. So I'm now able to really dig into this. And I started that 6 years ago. But I was amazed at how much information or how much research was out there that had never really been collated and applied to the world of work. So that's what I do now.
So let's hone in on, you know, what good does look like. Why is it that so much of our written communication doesn't work?
I think lots of reasons. I think one of the main ones is that we don't even think of writing as anything special. You know, now, sometimes we do. You know, if I say writing to most people, they often look at me a bit quizzically and say, "Well, how do you mean creative writing, or do you mean handwriting?" And I say, "No, that thing you're doing all day, because far from dying out, writing has become something that we've come to rely on. We write more now than ever, than at any other point in human history, and you know, we use." There were 219 million smartphones sold in the US alone last year, and they hardly ever get used for speaking. If my phone rings, I assume something's wrong. So it's this right. invisible medium. We just don't think that it's anything different. We think of it as talking. So, and you can see this in the way that live chat has taken over customer service desks. You know, it's very hard often to speak to a company if you want to get some kind of support, if you want to make a complaint, or even if you just want to inquire sometimes to spend some money with them. And with this march of live chat is a complete misnomer, because it's not live and it's not chat. It's not live because it's asynchronous. You send a message, someone reads it, they send a message back. And it's not chat, it's writing. So we don't see it. It's hidden.
Sorry, I just want to pause there, because I think you said something which I'd not thought about before or recently, which is that we've never written more than we write now more than we've ever done before. I mean, that's something just to pause around, because I remember seeing not so long ago a piece of research that showed that in 1995, the average manager got about 10 pieces of mail a day. So, you know, there's two sides to that. One is the receiving part of it, but the other is the production side of it. We weren't writing in those days. We were probably having more meetings and more telephone calls and so on. The volume of written material now is, as you say, vast. We're almost constantly writing if we're not in meetings. What are the consequences, not just on, you know, sort of the production of writing? What do you think has happened to writing itself as a result of that?
First of all, just to pick up on that stat, last year we sent and received 319 billion emails every day. And that number is going up by 15, wow. That daily number is going up by 15 to 20 billion every year. Per day, you know, that's the daily figure. So so it has taken over. I think the consequence is that we think, you know, whereas before you would have sent a memo, you would have sent a letter, maybe, and you would have put a lot of thought into that because it was quite a difficult thing to do. Just the logistics of it were quite difficult. Now it's very, very easy. The tools we use to send these things have become an extension of our brains. I think you've spoken to Annie Murphy Paul before, and this idea of the extended mind. We grow networks when we use tools repeatedly. We grow networks in our brain for using those tools. Not just humans, you know, it's been shown in other animals too. And so we have these tools, and they are extensions of our brains, but crucially of our brains, not of other people's, not when we're writing. So when you're receiving a message, yes, you've got this tool in front of you, which is an extension of your brain, but it's not really connected to the other person's brain. And in fact, when we write, when we are in that mode of sending a message, or creating a message, we are solitary normally. And so we are acting, we are behaving, our whole brain setup is working on the assumption that we're on our own and there's no human interaction there at all. And so the mechanisms that are normally at play when we're speaking to somebody are often, many of them are just not at play. And in fact, there's there's some research that oxytocin isn't released when you are reading a message, and is released when you're hearing somebody speak the same message. And oxytocin, this biochemical that's central to human interaction, it's like a social lubricant that helps us respond to people and interpret what they're saying, that it looks like that's not there when we're reading. So we're operating in isolation, and yet we create something in isolation and then send it to somebody who is disconnected from us in a human sense, and then they receive it. So we're kind of in a completely different mode when we're sending stuff, when we're writing stuff, and we're in a completely different mode than we would be naturally when we're reading it. Now, the crucial thing, for the crucial reason that we're at a disadvantage here, is that we didn't evolve to read and write. The earliest writing that's been discovered was from about 5,000 years ago in Iraq, in Mesopotamia, and most people, you know, the democratization and kind of spreading into the general population of writing really has only happened in the last few hundred years. So that's not enough time to evolve a brain that's set up for reading and writing. So when we're born, with a brain that's set up to acquire spoken language, and we do that passively. As long as people are speaking to us, we pick that up. But that's not the case with reading. To learn to read properly takes 10 years. And the reason it takes that long is because we have to rewire our brains and join together parts that we evolved for other things. And so the consequence is that it goes wrong all the time, because we use it to do an awful lot of heavy lifting, and it can't always do that heavy lifting. So it can leave us more prone to emotional reactions, to misinterpreting what we're reading. You know, we should dig into that, because that's a whole thing. You know, we don't see what's there; we see what we expect to see, and it leads to, you know, it holds people back. It's the reason that good ideas get stuck in organizations. It's the reason often that people don't progress in their jobs. And writing is the common thread that joins everything together. So if you think of strategy and execution and results and feedback, this kind of cycle that companies use to progress, it's communication that joins all of those. But usually it's not spoken communication, not mostly, it's written communication. You will be able to reach far more people by writing to them in a work context than you would by speaking to them. And not only that, you do it all day. You know, it's just something we're all doing without being aware of it.
So, I mean, this is fascinating, and I think the breadth of the limitation, the ideas that I'm sure you're researching from a neuroscience and psychological perspective in terms of the limitations of writing and what can we just fast forward, because I'm sure the listener's thinking, so what do we do about it? You know, can we just, I want to come back to some of the kind of root cause and some of the underlying mechanisms here, but give us a sense of the kind of things that we can do to overcome those limitations.
Okay, well, the first thing is to realize that writing is different from speaking, and that you are on the back foot already, and quite often you shouldn't be writing at all. So if you're dealing with anything that's particularly complex or emotive, then generally you're better off speaking to the other person rather than writing to them. And if you remember nothing else, remember that. I've had people say that to me. They've said, I've tried that, it worked. I found myself in a back and forth. I was trying to write this email and to just combine lots and lots of different things, lots of caveats. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to pick up the phone. And she managed to solve it within a couple of minutes. The whole thing got better within seconds. So don't try to use writing for something that it really is. It's not, it can't do. The second thing I would say is don't confuse complexity with quality or sophistication, because quite often when we do write, we end up using words that are quite difficult to process. And so what you end up doing then is drawing on mental resources that could be used to interpret your message and decide to act on it or decide what to do. If you tie up the reader's brain with trying to translate what you've written and follow what you've written, then you're just going to tire them out. You know, we've got this quite low cognitive load threshold, and it's very, very easy to exceed that, just overload the reader's brain, and they either don't read what you've written, or they can make quite irrational decisions, or they make no decision. We have a status quo bias that, you know, if we're not sure what to do, usually we'll do nothing. And what I mean by that is not necessarily stripping out all jargon. People talk about plain English, and that can lead people to think that we're talking about dumbing down. And we're not. We're talking, you know, using technical terms is fine as long as they are the reader's technical terms. As long as the person, your audience, as long as they use those terms already, then those are fine. In fact, they can be a really good way of signaling that you are in their group, you are part of them, you understand them. But it's the words in between the jargon that often clog things up. So things like, you know, saying in view of the fact that, when you could say despite, you know, it's so easy just to, even words like however, when you could use but, it's so easy just to clog up the brain with longer words. And people often do this where they start a sentence with a very long caveat. So they might say, owing to the fact that, blah, 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 and because of this and seeing that, I think we should do whatever. And what you're asking the reader there to do is to remember lots of qualifying information when they don't even know why. So, and then they have to go back and put the sentence together again. And you can see this. You can see this in eye tracking studies. You know, when people, as soon as people see things that they're not expecting to see or they don't quite get, they flip back and it just slows down reading and it overloads the brain and it puts you at a disadvantage. So don't confuse clever, flowery language or actually don't confuse clear language. Don't conflate it with being simplistic, because it's not. Clear language is often exactly what you need. And the next thing I would say is bear in mind that people don't read stuff, that most of reading is prediction. It's just the way our brains are set up. The eye is limited in what information it can take in. And so there are 10 times as many connections going from the visual cortex in the brain to the something called the thalamus, which for our purposes, we can think of as kind of neural junction box. And from there, these signals get sent out to other parts of the brain. So there's 10 times as much coming from the visual cortex to the thalamus as there are connections coming from the eyes to the thalamus. So, you know, it's 10 times as much is expectation rather than signal. And so what we're doing when we're reading is we're kind of skimming and we're expecting and we're seeing if what we're expecting to see is true. And that's why, you know, you get this situation where you think, well, I wrote it down. Didn't they read it? Or you suddenly get this reply, this email reply, and you go, no, that's not what I said at all. Why are they saying that? Well, it's because we don't read these things. It's just, you know, you're fighting against that, and everything you pile in, like complex, overly complex language, sentences that are way too difficult to process, messages that are way too long, they all work against you and can, you know, reduce the chance that people will read it at all.
Sometimes people start their emails with per my last email, which feels a lot like code for, hey, dummy, we covered this before, right? Yeah. I'm really fascinated by this because, you know, I tend to want to pick up the phone or in today's world, you know, hit somebody up on Teams or something. And sometimes you need to talk to more than one person at once. So you pull a few people in. But, you know, a popular axiom nowadays is this could have been an email. Like, why'd you waste my time with this? Right. And so there's almost this over direction, like people being over directed or wanting to direct others to just put it in my inbox and I'll get to it later. But I can see all the problems with that. And I can also think about a listener right now who might be saying, what if I need to get a message out to 10 people quite quickly? And I'm now hearing you talk about this idea that, you know, we are filling in the blanks. People are going to interpret messages differently. You know, that message that goes out to 10 individuals could have 10 different interpretations. What is somebody who feels the pressure to communicate quickly, how do they handle this when they want to mitigate any chance of their written communication failing them?
Well, first of all, I'm not saying never use email. You know, we could not be building these organizations and making the progress that we've made, actually, even since I set up that company, since I set up Emphasis. We could not be doing that without these amazing tools. So, you know, it's great for mass communication. It's great for sending something out to 10 people, and much more practical usually than having a call with them. Not least for the fact that you don't even have to do it in real time, especially if you're working across time zones. You know, you could write something in the evening and schedule it to send out, you know, either across the globe or tomorrow morning. You know, it gives us the opportunity to travel in time. But what I would do is don't make the message too complex. Don't try to do too much in that message. Or if you are trying to do a lot of heavy lifting, then don't put that at the beginning. You know, you can summarize at the beginning, or you can lead people in, and you can say, if you want more detail, I've put it at the foot of this email. I did this myself. I had to send actually what was quite a complex email to somebody a few weeks ago, and they'd never met me. But I'd been introduced by somebody, but I didn't know how much information they had. So I was in that strange quandary about whether I should give them all this background, because I wasn't even going to get a phone call with this person if I couldn't establish that it was relevant. Or do I just say, no, as per this person's, I wouldn't say as per, but I thank you for this person for introducing us. Not sure how much you know, and keep the email quite short. And what I did was I did both. So I just kept it to three short paragraphs, which was basically saying why I wanted to talk with this person and why I wanted to talk now. And then I said, you know, I'm not sure how much background you've got, but from this other person. So I've included more background below, you know, in fact, after my sign off. So I signed off, and then there was, you know, another two pages, which gave them all the information they needed if they didn't have it already. So it's just being cognizant of the reading process, you know, and incidentally, I did that deliberately in the email rather than putting it in an attachment. I used to say, put it in attachment. When I started off Emphasis, that's what I would say. If it's detailed, put it in a Word document, attach it. And often that can be good. That can be really helpful. But if you're sending it to somebody who's very, very busy, then that's another barrier. You know, they've now got to click on it. They've got to open it. You know, maybe they're reading it on their phone, and maybe they haven't got a document reader on their phone, and you're just putting in you're building more friction and putting up more barriers. So increasingly with things like that, it can be better to put it in the body of the email. So it's just really being aware of that, but also being aware that when somebody reads a message, they could be anywhere. So, you know, that's risky. They could be you know, they could be late for dropping the kids off at school, and they just, you know, their phone pings and they look at it and read your email. Or they could be reading it in a traffic jam, in a misguided attempt to kind of relieve their stress, which obviously a bad idea for more than one reason. And if they are stressed, we have this bias called the affect heuristic, which which says that when we are experiencing a certain emotion, we look for things in our environment that to confirm that we're right to experience that emotion, and that can explain why when people are stressed they can send you a snarky reply or not give you the response you were hoping for. That's often because they're reading the message somewhere else. So it's trying to be aware of that as well.
So can we just think about this together for this point you made earlier on about the expectation effect, the fact that we've got this predicting brain, so we already have constructed a picture of what this email is before we've even read it, and that might be informed by our circumstances. You say we're in the car, so this is a nuisance competing with looking after the kids, or it might be this is coming from Bob and he's an idiot and he's going to be asking something unreasonable, or this is from my boss and this is now like a potential criticism of something I've done, whatever. So you have this expectation. How do you disrupt expectation? What's the easiest way of getting people to kind of open their minds to what they're about to read?
It's sometimes it's the opposite to what you'd expect, because there's some advice out there that says put the bottom line up front, give them the news, then give them the background, and it's what you've got to do first really is to orientate the reader, almost to get them nodding, to get them to relax, to get them to drop their shoulders. When you speak to somebody, if you've been having a tense exchange on Slack or instant message, and you say, let's have a chat, and then you actually get to see that person, often the first thing that will happen is you'll see their shoulders drop and your shoulders will drop. And that's partly the result of oxytocin. And you've got to try to mimic that, even though you don't have all of those tools at your disposal. The department stores back when, I don't even know how many department stores were around anymore, but I remember reading years ago that one of their first jobs when they got you in the door was to decompress you, to get you to transition from being out on the street and thinking about catching the bus or whatever it is, to being in their store. And often you would find they would have, for instance, if they had the doors open, they'd have a warm air blower. Not something we would really recommend now, but that was, I can remember when that was quite common. You'd walk in and it'd be this curtain of warm air, and so you'd feel warm. The idea was it would relax you, and then there's probably a perfume counter or something. And what they're trying to do is to decompress you and get you to transition into that mode of being in their store and thinking, oh, what do I, I wonder what they've got here. I wonder what I can buy, and to forget what you were doing before. Now, that's often what you need to do when you're trying to get somebody on side. You need to decompress them. You need to get them to drop their shoulders. And often the best way to do that is to tell them something they agree with, something you know they know, and something that's not particularly threatening. So, one piece of advice I've heard is, with this bottom line up front idea is, you just go straight to it, and that could be quite negative. So you could say something like, we're cutting the budget by 30%. Now, that's the bottom line, but what you're going to get there is an emotional reaction, and that's going to increase this prediction effect and mean that emotions take over. Everything else you say after that is going to be fighting an uphill battle. Whereas if you say, oh, thanks for coming to the meeting last week, we discussed a budget and as we said, we're going to need to be a bit careful. So I've been looking at the figures and it looks like we're going to need to make some pretty big cuts. Now, it's still not great news, but you're giving somebody a bit of space to orientate themselves, to decompress, to get their mind around it. And incidentally, you're telling a bit of a story as well, and that can help with communication. If you say the figures show we need to make cuts of 30%, that's one thing. But if you say, I've been looking at the figures and the spreadsheet you gave me, and it seems to me, now I know, you know, it's counterintuitive because you're using more words, but what you're doing there is you're putting yourself in the story, you're conjuring up an image, and in doing that, you're making it easier for the person to process, and you're also orientating them. And the one other thing I would say with that is don't overuse bullets. And this is another piece of advice that you see a lot. You know, use bullets, great way of getting across a lot of information very quickly. Bullets are usually devoid of narrative, and reading a list of bullets is often like reading somebody else's revision notes for an exam. You know, if you haven't been to the lectures and you're trying to study for an exam, you know, the bullets will mean everything to the person who wrote them and nothing to you. And being devoid of narrative, they'll leave you to construct your own narrative. So when you overuse bullets like that, it's like you're handing over control of the conversation and interpretation to the reader for them to make up their own narrative. And it comes back really to a thing we get wrong, which is that we assume that writing is just a case of transferring information from one brain to another and transferring data. You know, we think of the brains as computers, and it's like, I've got this data and I'm going to transfer it into their head, and I just need to put it into my computer or my phone and send it, and then they will pick it up and job done. And it's just doesn't work like that. It's far, far more complex, and therefore there's far more risk of going wrong.
Yeah. These are some really, this is so fascinating. And these are great, great tips for the writer. I'm curious, sort of switching gears perhaps to the reader for a moment, as recipients of all these emails and texts we get, what are some ways that we can try to minimize the number of ways we fill in stories or fill in blanks that are, you know, when data is missing or context is missing rather, and we're sort of filling in the blanks and telling ourselves a story. What are some techniques or some mindfulness ways of thinking about how to not fall prey to that misunderstanding as a reader?
Well, Scott, you used the term mindfulness, and mindfulness is the key. Mindfulness, of course, is also something that's much easier to say than to achieve. So it takes a lot of practice, and you know, often we're battling the fact that the apps are there to are designed to grab our attention. And it's, of course, it's not just email, it's social media, for instance, much of which, if not most of which, is written. So these things are clamoring for our attention. So it takes a lot of practice. I use, for my own mental health, I use other apps that block content sometimes, that block certain thinking, for instance, of news. You know, I'll switch off the news between 8 o'clock in the evening and 9 o'clock in the morning, so that I'm not there looking at this as soon as I wake up in the morning, and so that I don't get stuck, because it's written to get you to doom scroll, and actually it's written to get an emotional reaction, and that does apply to the professional world as well. You know, you are going to have an emotional reaction to an awful lot of things, and it's going to increase your stress levels. So unless you can crack this, and unless you stop being a passive recipient of these things, then it's never going to get any better. So it's, you know, I think news is a good kind of an analogy, really, especially as we're often checking the news at work anyway. You know, often news headlines are written in a way that they will take advantage of this prediction effect. And in linguistics, in psycholinguistics, it's called the garden path model, which is that we read the beginning of a sentence and we kind of make up the end. And in fact, you get more of a reaction when something's unexpected. So if I were to say, I have a problem with my mouse, now you're probably going to think, what is it? Is it not working? You know, and then I said, you know, it hasn't eaten for days. I need to take it to the vet. The probability these days is when you talk about a mouse, you're probably going to be referring to something that you use with a computer, not to a small furry animal. So we're using prediction there. There was a not to go too far off topic, but I did a study in 2020 in the teeth of the pandemic, and looked at tens of thousands of news headlines from around the world and analyzed them. And there was up to a fivefold increase in the use of emotive words. And I don't mean things like pandemic or illness or disease, which you'd expect, but words like threat and plague, and you know, and these words are like in the top 200 most triggering words in the human language. And the best one I saw, best in scare quotes, was in the Daily Mirror, and it was tragic coronavirus death toll rises by lowest figure in 7 weeks. Now, that was a way to bring maximum emotive reaction out of good news. And even most people reading that would go, oh, tragic coronavirus death toll has risen. Oh, no, you know, and actually it was selling good news. So, but you see this, and you'll see this even in headlines in YouTube videos. You know, they are there. You look at the front of these headlines, that, you know, the first few words, and they are the most important. So really, you do have to get mindful and be aware of what all written communication is doing to you and how your brain isn't set up for it and how it therefore can produce a much stronger reaction. And therefore you need to use some of these apps to try to control it. If you're talking about practical, I leave my phone downstairs when I go to bed. I don't take it upstairs with me. And it's so that when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I don't do is check my email. You know, fortunately the news is blocked, but I know I might need to email early in the morning, so I don't block that. But you know, just be use physical barriers if you can, just so that your monkey brain is not going to be responding, because especially when you're tired, you're going to get stuck in these things and it's going to mess you up.
If you're enjoying The Evolving Leader, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. And don't forget to follow along on Instagram and LinkedIn. You can find us at Evolving Leader. Thank you for listening. Now, let's get back to the show.
When you think about writing, I'm just fascinated how you get into a more empathetic headspace, how you start to think about what it's like to be on the receiving end of whatever you're writing. Because often when you're writing stuff, all you're focused on is you're writing to understand what you think as much as anything else. And you're writing to understand what you want to say and communicate and what outcome you want the other person. You're not writing for the reader. And, you know, when you said, you know, we don't create oxytocin through our writing, novelists do, I'm sure. When you read, I'm just reading something at the moment, and you know, I am feeling a lot, you know, on all sides of the emotional spectrum. Mostly when you read something that makes you feel something, it's triggering, as you said, and that's not intended. It's just how, you know, the selfishness or the judgmentalness or the, you know, the one-sidedness of it makes you feel. How do you get into other people? How do you get a more empathetic mindset for writing?
It can help to step away. So, and that, you know, to go back to the earlier point about how you manage these things, you know, I would say never write when you're under the influence. Somebody used that phrase to me a couple of years ago, and he meant under the influence, obviously of alcohol, but he meant of emotion, because it's like, you know, it's like drunk texting when you're in an emotive space. You are not going to see what's there. And so walking away sometimes, where, you know, if somebody has written something and, you know, you might have the most negative possible interpretation of it. Often when you go back and you've calmed down, which you know, usually takes at least 20 minutes, you'll see it differently. So I would say walk away if you are responding to something that, you know, you has upset you. So if you're upset, everything will be screaming that you want to reply, and your prediction will be saying what you've written is perfectly logical. This is the This is why it's so insidious and so difficult to overcome. You will just have this voice screaming to you that it's fine, it's logical, what you've written makes sense, send it and you'll feel better. You won't. You know, so it's getting into that habit. But if you're writing to something, to somebody, and it's not in response, then it's, you need to do something definite to put yourself in their shoes, because as you said, you're in your own space. And in fact, this is something we do a lot. We write to clarify our thoughts. We shouldn't, because often what we send is a permanent record of what could be a very jumbled and illogical thought process. But unfortunately, it makes sense to us because we felt better by the time we'd finished writing it. So we kind of get lured into this false sense of security and into thinking that it's logical. So I wouldn't do that either. And in fact, one way to overcome that and one way to solve a lot of problems is to write the message before you've put the person's name in the recipient box. And in fact, even to write it in a notes app, so you can't send it without being ready. And then again, yeah, Everything will be screaming, don't do it, but to wait before you send it. And what I do sometimes is I will then put it in the email, in my email program, and then send it to myself. So if I write it on my laptop and send it to another email address I've got and open that on my phone, and then open it in a different location on your phone. You know, so again, you're just trying to mimic what it might feel like to receive that. And then to really get into their headspace and to maximize the chance you'll be able to empathize with them, you need to write down, if it's really important, I would write down, you know, what do they know already? And that's, you know, it's, we can't unknow stuff that we know. So that's not as daft as it sounds. You know, it's very, very easy to overestimate how much other people know when we're thinking about it all the time. So we assume an awful lot. So how much do they know? What do they need to know? But most importantly, what do they want to know? Because what we want governs most of our actions, when they're most of our voluntary actions, not what we need. And even if they need it, you've got to make them want it. So you've got to think, okay, so what do they want? What are their priorities? What are they likely to be thinking about right now? And then you have to then tie those together. And that's, as I say, that's often best done away from email, even on a piece of paper and going old school.
I know somebody who told me the other day that what they do is when they do all the things you talked about, and then they'd go an added step, which is then they read the email out loud. And as soon as they do that, they hear it for the first time, and they, they often cringe because, like, it's too abrupt or it's wrong or it's, you know. But we don't have that voice running through our head when we're writing, do we? We don't have a parallel voice. We just see it. I'm just interested to know how you think from a neurological point of view those different processes work, because I think the prediction part is probably playing a big part in your writing as well. When you write something, you're predicting what people will take from it. When you listen to it, there's another part of your brain that must be interpreting it.
Absolutely. I mentioned that when we're learning to read and write, we join together parts of the brain that we evolve for other purposes. When we're reading, we involve obviously our visual system, but we also involve our auditory system and even our voice production system. There's evidence that when we're reading something, they're imperceptible to the human eye, but if you amplify them, that your voice box is vibrating. You know, there are these micro movements of the muscles in the larynx, so voice production is even involved. So you literally, almost literally, have a voice in your head when you're reading it. And you can tell, you can tell that something is, that the auditory system's involved because of the mistakes we make. The other day I wrote the word could, C-O-U-L-D, and I meant to write the word good, G-O-O-D. Now, those words sound very, very similar. There's only one sound, the G sound or the C sound, that's different. But they've only got two letters in common, and obviously they mean totally different things. So I could only have confused those things if I'd heard the sound in my head. And that's what we do. The other thing we have in our head is like a kind of a playlist, like a backing track. And we, that's playing when we're writing, and we can hear it. And that then is, we're using that to clarify the message that we're writing. So it's a bit like, you know, it's a bit like if you're ever singing to favorite music, and you've got earphones in, and to you it sounds amazing because you can hear this whole band, and you know, you can hear the whole backing track, and you're there in the moment. And anybody else listening to it who can't hear that, it thinks it's terrible, you know, because they've only got this one track, and all this other information is missing. And that's a bit like, that's a bit what it's like. What it's like when we're writing, you know, we can hear this backing track, but as you say, the other person has got their own backing track. They've got their own voice in their head. So, you know, so that's a problem. But the other this idea of actually reading it out loud is a very, very good one, because our reading speed is much, much slower than. Reading out loud is much, much slower than reading silently. So reading out loud forces the brain to see what's actually there by slowing it down, rather than what it expects to see. And that can really help. There was an experiment. You know, an awful lot of this science is not new. It's just not. You know, the specialists working in these areas know all about it and probably take it for granted. But certainly in the working world and in the wider world, it's often unheard of. And there was an experiment carried out in 1975 called the Moving Window Experiment. And two scientists, Keith Rayner, George McConkie, and they set up a system that replaced everything that someone was reading with gobbledygook. So I didn't even know computers could do this back then, but you know, they used must have been a very expensive computer system, and they replaced everything with gobbledygook, with complete nonsense, except for a moving window of just a few letters, you know, five or six letters, can't remember exactly how many. And wherever the person looked, because they connected it to an eye tracker, wherever they looked on the screen, the correct text would appear there. And everything else would be replaced by nonsense. And the participants never realized. They did not clock a thing. And that what that shows is that it's a very, very narrow window in the on the retina. And we actually are seeing very, very little information when we read. Our eyes move across in a series of hops called saccades, each lasting just a fraction of a second. We have this illusion that everything's nice and smooth, and it's not. It's really, really jerky, and the brain is doing everything else. This smoothness is an illusion created by the brain, and that really provides a clue to why it goes wrong, because, as I said, most of the signal is coming from the brain, not from what you're reading.
So interesting.
Do younger generations approach this set of challenges differently? Do they read and write differently?
Yeah, I don't have empirical data on that, but anecdotally, I've certainly seen enough evidence of that through my association with Emphasis and also my own life outside of work. It's I think that email is not a tool that generation uses that much. And you know, they've grown up with, of course, they've grown up with the internet, but they've grown up using text messaging and then instant messaging through, for instance, Instagram, and have moved away even from text messaging quite often. So there's this kind of yawning gap between how they're communicating and how you communicate in the workplace. So quite often they've never even written an email. And so we might think that it's an easy step, but even emailing in the first place can be, it's not something you should assume that people can do, and quite often they need to be shown how to do it. Even the concept of even reading email, I've seen that that younger generations will often not even read email because they're just not used to doing it. But also, they are, you know, again anecdotally, but more prone, more likely to use instant messaging than to speak. So, I've seen someone who was I think he was 18, 19 at the time, and a relative of mine, and he said, you know, there's this. His phone kept ringing, and it was someone he was communicating with, and he said, why does he keep ringing me? And it was that, even doing that, it just felt like a real affront that someone would ring, would phone him rather than sending a message, that they would actually want to talk. So we're, as we do this, we're talking less and less. And you need to be aware of that as well, and don't take it for granted.
Rob, how can our listeners get in touch with you?
Well, this, as I do this research, as I wander through this world of science, and it's a great privilege to do this and to just bury myself in this research and try to communicate it and spread the word. I'm adding to an email and audio based course called Silent Influence, and it's free. So it starts off with five emails. And as I discover more, I write more lessons and tack them on to the end. And it's got audio as well, for reasons it should be clear now, that to help with that reading load, if you like, so that people can listen to these as a podcast, as you would a podcast, rather than me adding to the burden of their reading load. But to sign up for that, as I said, it's completely free. It's called Silent Influence. If they go to my website, which is robashton.com, if they go to robashton.com/influence, then they'll find a sign up form there, and they can make their way back to the other stuff on that site if they want to get in touch. And I'd love to talk about this, so you know, people should get in touch. It's almost an obsession now, and I really feel like we need to get this message out there, because this is something that people aren't talking about enough, and it's just influencing almost every aspect of our lives.
It's fantastic. This has been really fascinating. Thank you for sharing all of these insights. I've learned a lot in this hour, so thank you.
Me too. I mean, this notion of we're talking less and writing more is, when you say it, you kind of go, yeah, that's true. And the implications of it are massive, but we're not really thinking about it. So I think raising our awareness and some of the ideas you've given us are incredibly useful. And there's an awful lot more to unpack in this. So I really encourage people to look at your work and help you make sense of it as well. So thank you, Rob. Really fascinating.
It's been my absolute pleasure. I've enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on the show.
And for our listeners, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?